This episode is sponsored by Lifeway Kefir. I've been talking about Lifeway Kefir for the last few episodes now, and quite a few of you have reached out to me and told me that you're really enjoying them so far. And to be honest, I can't say I'm surprised. These little cultured dairy drinks not only taste great, but they're loaded with healthy nutrients, making them the ideal snack. With 11 grams of all-natural protein, 12 different probiotics, 30% of your daily calcium requirement, plus the fact that they're 99% lactose-free, how can you possibly go wrong? Look for them in the dairy aisle at your local grocery store, and be sure to go to lifewaykefir.com/courtjunkie for an exclusive offer just for you court junkies. That's Lifeway, KEFIR.com/courtjunkie. Hi, this is Jillian, and you are listening to episode 12 of the Court Junkie podcast. Welcome back to our regularly scheduled episodes. I hope you all had a wonderful new year and are ready to make 2017 your best year yet. But before we get started with today's episode, I want to thank all of you, as always, for your support. Thank you for listening, subscribing, sharing with your friends, and leaving me reviews. If you haven't subscribed to this podcast yet, please make sure to hit the subscribe button right after listening to this episode. Now, on to the show. Today's episode is about a case that literally changed the ways in which we search for missing people. It's a case that occurred in 2007, and perhaps one of the scariest things about this case is that it truly shows you that no one is ever really safe. Not even as you're running a quick errand on a warm summer Saturday in broad daylight. In June 2007, Kelsey Smith was 18 years old. She was the middle child of five kids, two older sisters, and a younger sister and brother. Her parents were Missy and Greg Smith, and the family lived in Overland Park, Kansas, a suburb of Kansas City. Kelsey had just graduated from Shawnee Mission West High School, where she had been involved in the marching band, theater, and track. I spoke with Kelsey's mom, Missy, for this episode. On Saturday, June 2, 2007, Missy received a phone call that every mother dreads receiving.
When Kelsey first went missing, I was actually on a trip home from Des Moines, Iowa. My friend's son had gotten married that weekend, and the engine had gone out in my minivan, which was probably a godsend. So my friend was driving me home, and I was about an hour away. Des Moines, Iowa was about 3.5 hours away from Kansas City, our home. And about an hour out, our daughter Lindsay called me and asked me if I had heard from Kelsey. She said, "Mom, Kelsey's not answering her cell phone." And I said, "Call John." And she said John was here at the house, and I told her to tell her dad, call the police, something was wrong.
The John Missy is referring to was Kelsey's boyfriend. And when she heard that John hadn't even heard from her, she knew that something was wrong. Had you ever not been able to get a hold of Kelsey before?
No, Kelsey was a very responsible teen. We had a message on our answering machine that the police had listened to. She was stuck in traffic on her way home from work and was just calling us to let us know that she was stuck in traffic. We had a rule in our house when the kids were growing up that was, if you were going to be late, you better call your parents. If not, you were grounded 2 days for every minute you were late. It only took one time to be grounded 2 days for every minute. And her friends took it seriously when they started hearing she wasn't answering, because if all of her friends were together and they were running late or something, she would tell them, just call your parents. You may get in trouble, but you're not going to get in as much trouble as you would if you let them know. That was when, I mean, it was 10 years ago, but she did have a cell phone, and she would at least text us if she didn't answer her call or couldn't answer her call. She would text us and let us know what was going on. And she also, if she was at a friend's house, would text us to let us know, like, if they had gone up to get a Slurpee or gone to get a snack or went to someone else's house. She was very good at letting us know where she was.
The last time Kelsey had spoken to her mom had been just a few hours earlier. Kelsey had told her that she was going to make a quick run to Target.
I did know that she was going to Target. I was actually on the phone with her when she was walking into that Target store. She was going to look for a gift for John, her boyfriend. They were celebrating their 6-month anniversary of dating, and she wanted to pick up this certain gift for him, and she was calling me on the phone to ask me, Mom, where did you see that at in Target? And I said, I was describing to her where to get it, and she said, I'm not at that Target, I'm at the Target by the mall. So I was explaining to her where she could find that gift in Target.
Shortly after this phone call with her mom, Kelsey would go missing. So there were a lot of searches for Kelsey, like within the community after she went missing. Can you tell me about that? Like, how did that form and how did the word start spreading about her disappearance?
The searches began that early morning hours. I had given our daughter Lindsay my last $30 to go to Kinko's to start printing off flyers. And she had friends over, college age kids. They were the ones that actually conducted the search and were in the lead. Her friend Eric, he was friends with Lindsay and Kelsey, came to Greg and just asked him, how do you do a search for someone? And Greg explained to him how you do it in law enforcement. And Eric took it on along with another friend, Chris, and they just did it.
Kelsey's dad, Greg, was a police officer, so he was no stranger to dealing with this type of situation. But it's different, of course, when it's your own daughter who's in trouble. The search effort for Kelsey formed quickly. Friends, family, and members of the community rallied together in their efforts to find her. Later that night, Kelsey's grandparents found her car, a gray 1987 Buick Regal, in the parking lot of a Macy's across the street from the Target. Her purse and the bags that she had gotten from Target were still inside. Her cell phone and ATM card were missing from her purse. Within 48 hours of Kelsey being gone, police held a press conference and released surveillance video from the Target where Kelsey had been last seen. And what the video showed was horrifying. At 6:54 p.m., a dark-colored pickup truck pulled into the parking lot and into the same parking aisle as Kelsey's car. At 6:55 p.m., Kelsey is seen walking into Target. 1 minute later, a white male is seen walking into the store. He looks to be in his 20s, about 6 feet tall, 175 pounds, with dark hair and a goatee. He was wearing a white t-shirt, black shorts, and black tennis shoes. About 4 minutes prior to Kelsey coming out of the store, the man can be seen walking out and presumably waiting for her in the parking lot. At about 7:10 p.m., Kelsey is back out by her car, putting her purchases inside. As she opens the driver's side door, the man sprints up behind her and pushes her into the car. Then the car leaves the parking lot and drives out of view. At 9:29 p.m., about 10 minutes after Kelsey's grandparents find her car, the Target surveillance video shows the black pickup truck pulling out of the parking lot. Police stress that the man in the video was a person of interest and to please contact police if anybody recognized him. Kelsey's family offered a $30,000 reward for information about her disappearance. Needless to say, Kelsey's parents were frantic with worry. The police were now involved in the search, and so they decided to try another route. So they called Verizon, Kelsey's cell phone provider, to see if they were able to track where Kelsey's cell phone was. And if you follow cases today, you know that this is a pretty common method nowadays, but it wasn't back then.
Kelsey always had her cell phone on her. At that time, when she went missing, that's when you had a limited number of text messages that you could text each month. And when she was dating John, we had to up that plan many times because she kept going over the text messages. She was always with it. And I have a picture of her with her phone that I can share with you. That night when I pulled into the driveway, her boyfriend came up to me and he said, "Ma'am, my uncle worked for Sprint and he says you can ping her phone to find where she is." Little did we know, you know, what it was. He explained to us what it was. We called Verizon at the time and they're just telling us they can't do that, to get onto the computer to see what her cell phone activity had been. And that's when our saga with Verizon began.
Kelsey's parents ran into a lot of resistance trying to track her phone. But Kelsey was rarely without her phone, so they knew that if they could track it, they would have a good chance of finding her. So what was Verizon's response? They basically were telling you that they didn't have the capabilities of doing that?
They never said they didn't have the capability. All they kept saying to us was, "We cannot do that." But even law enforcement, they weren't explaining to law enforcement they could not ping her phone. And they later explained to us that pinging a phone is to send an active signal to the phone, and the phone says, basically, "Here I am." It reacts to that signal that is sent. At that time, Verizon could not ping a phone, but Sprint, their headquarters is here in the Kansas City metropolitan area. A couple of weeks before Kelsey was kidnapped, there was a carjacking with a Sprint phone, and Overland Park Police Department had dealt with Sprint, so they knew this technology was out there because Sprint absolutely cooperated with them and helped them to locate the carjacking.
So Verizon had the technology, but they just, did they know that they had the technology to do it, or?
Verizon did not at that time, and I don't know if they do now. We've never gotten a clear statement from them. They could not send a signal to the phone and the phone react and say, "Here I am." What happened is when they rolled out their E911, they went cheap. They didn't add that feature. What they could do, though, was look at past locations of where Kelsey's phone had talked to their network. And eventually, that's what they looked at and narrowed down the search area for the police to be able to look for Kelsey.
So they were basically able to track where her phone was when she had last used it, not where it was currently.
Well, correct. Where history had been, because at any one time, at that time period, your phone talks to three different cell towers, and the strongest signal is the one that your phone will actually connect to.
Finally, 4 days after Kelsey's disappearance, Verizon agreed to track Kelsey's last phone activity. So then what happened when they were finally able to track the history of her phone?
They were able, the night before she was found, to finally, my understanding is there was a phone agent in the FBI, a technician that walked Verizon through exactly what they wanted. And they were like, "Oh yeah, we can do that." So once they got that information, it was the night before she was found on the 5th, and it was getting dark, and they were concerned for law enforcement officers getting lost because it was a very wooded area. So they went back out the next morning with a technician from Verizon, and he narrowed down the scope for him and said, "Look here. Here's where you need to look for her." And she was found in about 45 minutes, they said.
On June 6th, 2007, about 240 federal agents, police officers, and even police academy students went out to the area where Kelsey's phone had recorded its last activity. The last signal from her phone had been recorded at about 8 p.m., approximately 1 hour after Kelsey had been abducted, which was likely her family and friends trying to get in touch with her. They conducted a grid search of the area, and sure enough, they found her. Kelsey's body was just across the Kansas border, near a lake in Missouri, about 20 miles from where she was abducted. Because she was found in Missouri, across state lines, it was now a multi-jurisdictional case, meaning that authorities in Kansas, Missouri, and the federal government would all now be taking part in the investigation. But unbeknownst to anybody outside of law enforcement, they already had identified their main suspect, the man seen on the surveillance video. Earlier that morning, on the day Kelsey's body was found, investigators received a tip from a man who said that he and his wife had initially laughed it off when they noticed a resemblance between the suspect in the surveillance video and their next-door neighbor. But once they saw the images of the pickup truck, they knew that it was more than just a coincidence. And sure enough, the person of interest in the Kelsey Smith abduction was their next-door neighbor. Investigators had that man at their station later that afternoon, and by the end of their interview, 26-year-old Edwin Hall was under arrest. Before I continue, I want to take a second to thank my sponsor of this episode, Lifeway Kefir. Lifeway Kefir is responsible for those yummy cultured dairy drinks that you've likely seen in the dairy aisle of your local grocery store. They're delicious and healthy, and they make for the perfect snack. You could be drinking one right now as you're listening to this podcast. So not only do they have a great product, but they've been great in sponsoring Court Junkie, and I hope that they continue to. To get a special offer just for Court Junkie listeners, please visit lifewaykefir.com/courtjunkie. That's Lifeway, KEFIR.com/courtjunkie. And now, back to the episode. The next day, news of Edwin Hall's arrest hit the media. He was charged with first-degree murder and aggravated kidnapping in Kelsey's death. His bond was set at $5 million. Meanwhile, the public wanted to know who this guy was. Was he some freaky serial killer who lived in his parents' basement? A societal outcast, perhaps? They were stunned to find out that he was neither. In fact, he was married and had a 4-year-old little boy. But perhaps his MySpace page would shed a little bit of light onto who he really was. On his profile, Edwin, who went by Jack, wrote that he was a sweet, troubled soul who was interested in eating small children and harming small animals. He wrote that his favorite movies were anything that pushes the envelope, A Clockwork Orange, Strangeland, and let's not forget horror movies. The Associated Press ran a story about Edwin's past, and it wasn't pretty. He had been adopted at the age of 7, and his adoptive parents told reporters that they always knew that he was troubled due to things that happened in his early childhood. And then, when he was 15 years old, something happened that alarmed his adoptive parents, so much so that they ended up giving him up and he was returned to state custody. The incident reportedly involved threatening his adoptive sister at knife point, something he then pleaded no contest to. And now, 11 years later, prosecutors said they were considering seeking the death penalty against him. Kelsey's autopsy revealed that the cause of death was strangulation, and there was also evidence that Kelsey had fought her killer. But that wasn't all. On July 11th, 2007, Edwin was also charged with rape and aggravated sodomy. The premeditated first-degree murder count was changed to capital murder, making him eligible for the death penalty. That $5 million bond was revoked. That same day, Edwin appeared in court to hear additional charges not related to Kelsey, but stemming from a reported 2004 sexual relationship he had with a 14-year-old girl. In August 2007, Edwin officially pleaded not guilty to the charges of capital murder, kidnapping, rape, and aggravated sodomy. He had also talked to a reporter from jail and proclaimed his innocence, saying that he had seen Kelsey at Target, but all he did was look at her, and he said that the media got it wrong. But a year later, in July 2008, during a change of venue hearing, Edwin pleaded guilty. He had agreed to a plea deal with prosecutors. After the plea was entered, Johnson County District Attorney Phil Klein gave the court details of Kelsey's murder. Earlier in the day on that Saturday, June 2, 2007, Edwin dined alone at a Mexican restaurant near the Oak Park Mall, and he left without paying. After that, he went to the Dillard's at the mall. He told authorities that he had been shopping for a gift for his wife, but Klein said that he had no money on him and that he didn't buy anything. Edwin then went to the Target. Klein said Edwin told them that when he first saw Kelsey, he was at the jewelry counter. He thought that she was 12 years old and said that she had nice legs. He then started following her. When he saw her get into the checkout line, he headed to the parking lot to wait for her. Kelsey walked to her car and opened the passenger side door, putting her bags inside. She then walked behind her car, and when she opened the driver's side door, Edwin ran up behind her and forced her into the car. Klein said Edwin told them that he threatened Kelsey with an air gun to the back of her head. They drove to a wooded area, and that's where Edwin raped her. He then strangled her with a belt that she had in her car. Klein said, "The death was particularly cruel and heinous, and that death by strangulation requires several minutes during which the victim is fearful of their impending death." Klein said Kelsey's naked body was found in a wooded area near Longview Lake in Jackson County, Missouri. There were sticks that had been laid across her body, and her clothes were lying nearby. Her shirt had been stained with bleach, which Klein said indicated that somebody had tried to use bleach to destroy evidence. Klein also said that Edwin had wounds on his ear and on his knuckles, which meant that Kelsey had fought for her life. Among the evidence against him, Klein said, was DNA. Kelsey's DNA was found on a stain inside the zipper flap of Edwin's shorts. The chance that the DNA was anyone but Kelsey's was 1 in over 280 billion. Edwin's DNA was also found on the steering wheel of Kelsey's car, and there was a 1 in 5 million chance that it matched somebody aside from him. DNA from the driver's side seatbelt showed that there was a 1 in 923.4 million chance that the DNA did not belong to Edwin. And police had also found a blood stain on one of Edwin's shoes, and the DNA test from the shoes showed that Kelsey could not be excluded as a match. In addition to the DNA evidence, there was also an eyewitness account. A day after Kelsey's abduction, a couple spotted a man that matched Edwin's description coming out of the woods where Kelsey's body would eventually be found. The man was carrying a duffel bag, and he walked to a black pickup truck that had several wooden sticks in the back. Klein said that the sticks found on Kelsey's body matched the sticks found in the back of Edwin's pickup truck. Edwin's plea deal meant that he had agreed to serve life in prison, thus escaping the death penalty. Also as part of the deal, prosecutors agreed to dismiss the unrelated charges of aggravated indecent liberties stemming from that sexual relationship he had with the 14-year-old girl in 2004. According to Edwin, that had been consensual. I asked Kelsey's mom how she felt about the plea deal.
At first, I was not relieved that there was not going to be a trial. I was very adamant with the prosecution in that they needed to fight for her as hard as she fought for her life. But our other children came to us and said they needed to be able to start moving forward and they didn't want their children to have to deal with him for the rest of their life. And that made a very huge impact on us. And in Kansas, I don't know if it's everywhere, but in Kansas, the family does not get to decide whether or not a case moves forward. It is absolutely up to the DA. And he said this is what he was doing. And for our family, it ended up being best.
Edwin's sentencing hearing occurred on September 17th, 2008. The courtroom was packed with family, friends, and community members of Kelsey that wore light blue t-shirts that said Kelsey's Army on them. Kelsey's siblings and parents spoke to the court, and a video montage of Kelsey was played on the overhead from when she was a baby until her high school graduation, the month before she was killed. When Missy spoke to the court, what stood out to me was that she addressed Edwin's young son.
I will continue to pray for God to protect that little boy. He is going to need it.
I saw that at the sentencing hearing, you addressed Edwin's son.
Just as a mother, knowing the impact that a parent's actions have on a child, I was just empathetic for that baby.
Edwin was sentenced to life in prison without parole and about 47 years for aggravated kidnapping, rape, and aggravated sodomy. Edwin also spoke to the court.
I am so, so sorry for what I've done. That's all I can say.
He said, I am so, so sorry for what I have done. That's it. That's all I can say. Edwin Hall will remain in prison for the rest of his life. And Kelsey's family will continue to try and move forward with theirs. After Kelsey's murder, her father, Greg, became involved in politics. In 2012, he served as a state senator. But what he and Missy weren't expecting was to run into Edwin Hall again.
Greg had a corrections when he was a state senator in Kansas, and we toured that facility and actually saw him in the lunchroom.
Oh my gosh. Did he know who you were?
At first he did not know, but then he got the look of recognition on his face, and that was all that occurred.
I'm sorry you had to see him. Were you expecting that, or was that a surprise?
Well, we knew he was at that facility. We knew at any one time we may run into him. So you're kind of anxious that you might, but in the end, I walked out the door and he didn't.
Although dealing with Kelsey's murder has no doubt been extremely painful, Missy and Greg have somehow found the strength to become activists. They've turned their ordeal with Verizon and trying to get help from Verizon in finding their daughter into the Kelsey Smith Act. The Kelsey Smith Act allows law enforcement to track the cell phone of a missing person. So can you tell me a little bit about the Kelsey Smith Act, what it is and how that came about?
The Kelsey Smith Act came about because when Kelsey was missing and I found out that even law enforcement could not get Verizon to release information to them as to her phone activity, even with a subpoena, they did not release the information. Greg, having been a police officer for almost 20 years, I just looked at him like, this is not right. And I said to him, you know, it either takes lawsuits or legislation to get large corporations to act. And a lawsuit wasn't going to change anything. So it was legislation. And we met with some legislators here in Kansas. The district attorney introduced us to some. And we explained to them what we wanted to do, and they said, we think we can do that. And now Senator Rob Olson, who was a representative at the time, he spearheaded it, got the language, made sure it was okay with us, and moved forward.
And in addition to the Kelsey Smith Act, Missy and Greg have also started the Kelsey Smith Foundation.
The Kelsey Smith Foundation is a nonprofit organization that Greg and I started after Kelsey was killed. We started researching, Greg being a police officer, different organizations to help keep people safe. Because if our daughter, who goes missing in broad daylight in the metropolitan area we live in, I mean, there were only two murders in Johnson County that year. and she was one. The other was a domestic. It just doesn't happen. We needed to make people more aware of how to be safe. And most of the programs in that we looked at were geared towards children. And we just said, we need to do something about this. So that's how it came about.
I spoke earlier about how Kelsey's friends, family, and supporters wore t-shirts to court that said Kelsey's Army on them. And that's because Kelsey's case touched a lot of people. After Kelsey went missing, Missy said her family was overwhelmed at the idea that Kelsey had an army behind her.
We received so many emails on that, and our son, thinking he was helping one day, said, Mom, I deleted all your emails so you don't have to read them. And I was like, oh. And he was 10 at the time, so.
Oh.
Yeah, he really thought he was helping. To this day, it surprises me when I will be somewhere, even if people don't remember her name, Kelsey, if you say the girl at Target in Kansas City, many times it will come back and people remember her, and that surprises me. I just think of her as my kid, just this little Kansas girl, and it's more than that.
If you're interested in getting more information about the Kelsey Smith Foundation, you can go to kelseysarmy.org. And if you're interested in helping them get the Kelsey Smith Act passed in your state, there's ways you can help with that too. It has already passed in 23 states, but Missy is determined to do more.
When everything happened with Kelsey, Greg and I just knew we had to make it better for someone else. That's what she would do. And I often joke that she probably would have more than 23 states by now, because she would be so pissed off at everybody for not listening that she would just be in their face and say, you got to get this done. You can contact legislators to, if you're one of the 27 states left, to say, we need this law in our state. And usually a legislator will listen to a constituent more than just someone coming in from the outside. That's how we got it in Tennessee. There was actually a 911 operator that had heard Kelsey's story, and she went to her representative and said, we need this. And so he listened to her and had me come in and testify there.
I wanted to cover Kelsey's story because I think all of us have been her at some point or another, where life is going great, it's a Saturday afternoon, and you decide to run to the store, like any other day, not a care in the world, just thinking about your plans later that day, or maybe the next day. It's broad daylight, you're at a familiar store. Sure, you've heard about abductions, but the furthest thing from your mind is that it's going to happen to you. Perhaps nothing could have prevented Kelsey's death, but I think that her death can help prevent others. Ever since I heard about what happened to her, I never look at running a simple errand in the same way. And I'm not exaggerating. It's important to be aware of your surroundings, aware that it can happen to you. So the next time you're doing something that you consider mundane and safe, just think of Kelsey, and maybe you'll be a little bit more aware.
Losing a child, it absolutely rips a hole into your heart that can never be filled. But you start to heal from it. You move forward. I don't say you move on. You never move on forward from it. But you do start to put one step in front of the other. And being 10 years out, there's not a day, almost 10 years in June, there's not a day that goes by that I don't miss Kels. But the frequency in which I feel that intense loss does get less. It's not as often now. But when I feel it, it is just as bad as being at the end of my driveway when the police officer told me she was gone.
I want to thank Missy for her strength and for speaking with me for this episode. And thanks to all of you for listening. If you like this podcast, please make sure to subscribe. And if you really like it, please leave me a review. I want to take a moment and thank more of my Patreon subscribers: Melissa, Chad, Lisa, Trina, and Anna. Thank you so much for your support. To make a donation of as little as $1 a month to this podcast, please go to courtjunkie.com/support. You'll get early ad-free access to Court Junkie briefs and episodes. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.